We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the year 2000, just over half of the states in this country had fully funded pension systems. But by the year 2008, only four could make that claim, and two states, Kansas and Illinois, had less than 60% of the money needed to meet their retirement benefit obligations. This morning, in this hour of Focus, we'll be trying to take a look at the problem of underfunded state retirement systems, both on the national level, and also we want to look very specifically at our state, the state of Illinois. And we have three guests. Joining us by telephone is Catherine Barrett. She's a principal in the firm of Barrett and Green, and has done research and writing on a wide variety of fields that have to do with state and local government. And she is joining us because she's also one of the lead contributors to a recent report issued by the Pew Center on the States. Just came out in February. The title is The $1 trillion Gap, and it takes a look at this very issue. And if that's something you'd like to read, you can go to their website, Pew Center on the States, and take a look at the report. She's also done work for the Pew Center on other topics, including tax policy, Medicaid, and infrastructure in the states. In addition to her work with Pew, she's a correspondent and management columnist for Governing Magazine. Now, here in studio with me have two guests, and both of them have been on this program before. Fred Gertz, he's an economist here at the U of I. He's been on the faculty of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs, and also has been professor in the Department of Economics since 1980. He's interested in things like public finance and regional economic development. He follows the state's economy quite closely. He served for a number of years as a member of the Board of Trustees of the State University's Retirement System. That's the retirement fund for Illinois Public University and college employees. He was on for 10 years. He was off for a little while. Now he's again serving in that capacity, and we're glad he's here. Also in the studio is Jeffrey Brown. He's professor of finance and director of the Center for Business and Public Policy here at the U of I. He is interested in a number of things, including employee benefits. He's a founding member of the Institutional Retirement Income Research Council. He is involved with the Retirement Research Center at the National Bureau of Economic Research, and has also done writing and research on this particular issue. And we're really glad they could all be here with us. Questions are welcome, and we want to tell people, I'm sure our guests will do their best to answer your questions. It can also help us if people can be brief. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, here joining us by telephone, Catherine Barrett. Ms. Barrett, hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks very much for being with us. And Professor Gertz and Professor Brown, thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
We want to try and do two things here to talk about, certainly talk about Illinois. I'm sure that there are a lot of people listening to us who will have questions about the state of Illinois, but also to talk a little bit about what this looks like on the national level. And I guess that one of the things that we have to say, and the report, Ms. Barrett, that you worked on made really obvious that while we have a very serious problem here in Illinois, this is a national problem. Can you give us just a very quick thumbnail sketch of what this looks like across the country?
Well, it is a national problem, and the trend lines are clearly moving in the wrong direction. We found that there was about $3.3 trillion in liabilities that the states had both for their pensions and for their retiree health benefits, and about $1 trillion of that is still unfunded.
And maybe let me ask you this question, because there are some states here that actually are doing well with this. So, you know, there are people who are in good shape and there are people who are not. Unfortunately, Illinois is not. How many states are there that actually are paid up as far as their or close to being paid up as far as their obligations are concerned?
We had 16 states that we listed as solid performers. We had it wasn't that we just looked at pension funding, but a few different criteria. And so There are a sizable handful of states that are doing quite well with their pensions.
Hmm.
What was interesting to us is just the huge variety in how states have handled this issue.
And just give us a couple of examples of what the huge variety is.
You have states like North Carolina, Florida, Wisconsin, Washington, New York, which are either fully funded or nearly fully funded. And then, as you mentioned, there are states like Illinois and Colorado and Kansas that really have a significant problem. And what we found is it just becomes so much so expensive year after year to have an underfunded system.
Mm. Well, just before I go to the guests in the studio here and just get them to react, tell us about the state of Illinois from what you have found.
There's not really a nice way of saying this. Illinois was right at the bottom. The funding was for the pension system was only at 54%, which was quite a bit below other states. And in addition to that, Illinois has a very sizable bill coming due for its retiree health benefits, about $40 billion.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to get a reaction here of our studio guest. I could just ask Fred to start. This certainly the information about Illinois that's in this report. This is no surprise to you.
There's no surprise, and it should be no surprise to anyone in Illinois. It's been coming for a long time, and there's absolutely no reason why we shouldn't have been doing something about it earlier. The unfortunate news here is that this is like doing a study of the economy in 1928 and then talking about 1929 or 1930. The report ended the fiscal year 2008, and then we had the market crash after that. So in most cases, things are actually worse than the Pew report suggests, because we had the unprecedented turmoil in the markets during 2008-2009. But let me now go on to talk about Illinois. Illinois clearly has a tremendous problem, and it's a problem that's been growing for a long time. The one thing that I'd like to point out is that Illinois' problem arose from a bigger problem. We don't just have a pension problem. We have a state finance problem. And for years, year after year after year, going back at least 20 or 25 years, maybe 30 years, the state every year has had the choice of funding its pensions well or doing other things, and they have a choice. Do we want to raise taxes? The answer was no. Do we want to cut back other programs? The answer was no. How do we fund all these things? Well, we don't fully fund the pension system. So year after year, we haven't put in enough, even though we knew exactly how much had to be put in. And this is sort of the magic of compound interest is if you save when you're young, you can retire well when you're old. The other side of the coin is if you don't save and your debts accumulated at compound interest, they become huge, and that's where we are today. So Illinois' problem is not just a pension problem. It's a state government finance problem. We have to address the overall issue.
Mm-hmm. Anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, Jeff? You know, fundamentally, this is a question that comes down to what economists refer to as intergenerational redistribution. What that basically means is that this is a question about we know we've got these pension obligations, especially in the state of Illinois. They're going to be very difficult to get out from under because we actually have a constitutional guarantee that the benefits cannot be impaired for those that are expecting benefits. So it's really a question of we know we're going to have to pay this bill. And it's an issue of who is going to pay it. And the way that the Illinois legislatures have dealt with this for the last 30 years has been to consistently underfund the pension and essentially just pass the burden along to the next generation. The reason this matters is, you know, we do this at a national level. The Social Security system, we don't really even make any pretense about trying to pre-fund that system. But it's a national program, and that has important implications for our national savings rate and so forth. But at the level of a state, it's particularly problematic because what we're really looking at is a future tax burden in the state of Illinois that is going to have to go up. And that raises concerns about what kind of environment we're creating, economic environment we're creating, whether this is a state that businesses are going to want to invest in and grow in and so forth. So, I mean, really this is ultimately boils down to a question about the long-term economic sustainability of the state and of the business environment that creates.
Mm-hmm. Let me just ask you this question, and I imagine it might be the questions that people would have. You need to have in the bank, you need to have the ability to be able to pay current retirees. So you know that you got to send checks out next month and the month after that and the month after that. So you got to at least have that much. But do you really need – how much money do you have that is going to pay benefits way into the future? I mean, do we really have to have the money in the bank now that we know that we'll need to pay the benefits 5 years from now or 10 years from now? How much reserve do you have to have?
Well, it's a question of whether you want to do it the hard way or the easy way. If you pre-fund it, you end up probably taking about 10% of people's salary in Illinois, employees in Illinois, to fund the pension system. You can fund it well at that 10% level. If you don't pre-fund it and go to a pay-as-you-go system, eventually you're paying, like now we're close to paying 20 or 25 or even 30% in the future. So it's a pay-as-you-go system is a very expensive way to do it. It can be done, but it's not the desired way, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's right. In fact, again, Social Security system for the country as a whole actually does operate on a pay-as-you-go basis primarily. And we've seen what happens when you do that, which is as retirees are living longer and longer and as there are fewer workers and so forth, that kind of a system becomes very difficult to sustain without those contribution rates going way up. Mm-hmm. So again, it's a question about who's going to bear that burden, and that really then boils down to how big that burden will be in each individual year.
I have a kind of a riveting example from Rhode Island.
Sure.
There is a local city fire department which is extremely underfunded, and so it's almost paying on a pay-as-you-go basis. So a couple of years ago, it paid $21 million to cover the benefits of 500 firefighters. So that's an underfunded system. The municipal system in Rhode Island is quite well-funded, and it paid a little bit less than that, $20 million, to cover 14,000 firefighters. So you can really see that if you don't fund these in advance, they get very expensive if you're just paying for people's actual benefits.
Yeah. I want to ask Catherine Barrett a question here. I think both of our guests have made this point, and somehow it's come up recently in shows have made this point, that while here in Illinois the Constitution mandates that benefits will be paid, it doesn't say to the legislature, you must also then fund them. It's up to the discretion of the legislature. You have so much money, so they decide where it's going to be spent, and it's up to them where that money goes, and there's no requirement that they put money into the fund as things go along. It's my understanding, Ms. Barrett, actually, though, that there are some states where the legislatures are actually mandated to fund their systems.
That's true, and they tend to be states that are, not surprisingly, much better funded. Arizona has a requirement to fund its pension system each year, and it's doing quite well. Florida as well has a requirement to fund the pension system, and it's been fully funded. So those kinds of requirements do help.
Here in the state of Illinois, has that ever been something that was up for discussion?
Not really. There was a lawsuit once about it was a class action suit saying that the pensions were underfunded and they should be the legislature should be made to fund them. And the court ruled that the non-impairment clause requires a payment of benefits. It doesn't require the pre-funding on the part of the state. Now, the non-impairment clause actually, in some sense, is a real benefit. It also creates what we talked about in another context, the financial context of the moral hazard situation. Employees, if we didn't know that we had the non-impairment clause, we as employees, university officials, government officials would be very concerned about future pensions, and they'd be very unhappy if pension contributions weren't being made. But because of the non-impairment clause, I'm willing to take a higher salary and not worry much about the state funding the pensions, because I know eventually the state's going to have to step up and do that. University of Illinois officials would rather have money coming to the university as opposed to going to the pension system right down the line. And legislators have a very short horizon as well. So the non-impairment clause is a great comfort to us in one sense, but also has created some incentive issues.
Yeah, in fact, I'd say in some ways it's created the worst of both worlds, which is individuals who work in the state system right now truly are protected by this impairment clause, which means the state and the taxpayers are going to have to come up with the money to pay those benefits. But we've actually done some surveys among participants in the system, and many of them believe that their benefits are at risk. Now, why does this matter? If you believe that your benefits are at risk, you don't value them dollar for dollar, and therefore you're going to demand to be compensated in some other form in order to make up for that. So we're in a situation where the taxpayers have basically committed to paying these benefits, but participants aren't valuing them fully, and therefore it's actually costing us more money in the long run as a result of this. Yeah.
So just to underscore that point, because I expect to get calls about this, and we've gotten calls about this before when it's come up on other shows, people are concerned. People may be are looking forward to retire someday. They're part of CSRS. I don't know when they think they're going to retire, 5 years, 10 years, whatever. And that's their question. The question is, when I get around to retiring, will the promised benefit be paid? Now, it sounds like from the answer that you just gave us, well, the answer is yes, it will be paid, but there's still some big questions about where the state government is going to find the money.
That's correct. And I would say, yes, the benefits will be paid. Now, that doesn't mean that the state may not look for ways to get out from under some of that obligation. Doesn't mean there won't be lawsuits involved in order to enforce it. But I can tell you that we are one of, I believe, 7 states that have this impairment or non-impairment clause in our state constitution. In other states like California and New York, where they have this, there have been instances where, you know, New York City has gone through budget crises in the 1970s, where municipalities in California have gone through these crises. What we have found is that the pensioners have always been made whole. So to the extent that we have any sort of case studies on what happens when the, you know, rubber really meets the road and these things are called into question, the pensioners are protected, even if it means that they have to default on their municipal bonds before they take any money away from the pension. So I actually think that as a retiree, I'd feel fairly comfortable. As a taxpayer, I'd be worried sick.
Yeah. The non-impairment clause is probably not going to be a great comfort to people. It does not apply to post-retirement non-pension benefits. Yes. So health care benefits are not guaranteed the same way. So the state could do anything they want. I mean, they're not likely to do this. They could discontinue health care. They could raise the payments that the retirees have to make, things of that sort. So, again, I'm not saying that's going to happen, but the same kind of guarantee doesn't apply to the base pension, to the non-base pension benefits.
And we're seeing a lot of states go in and make changes to their retiree health benefits now that they have to calculate what that number actually is. States like West Virginia and New Hampshire have made quite dramatic changes.
Yeah.
And the question we ask, how much is the our Illinois pension funded with around 50%? We ask, how much are our health care benefits and retirement funded? The answer is zero.
So the problem there is even more serious. We tend to focus on the pension, but the if you fold in the other cost as well, it's an even bigger problem. We have 3 guests with us. Joining us by telephone, Catherine Barrett. She's a senior advisor to the Pew Center on the States, has been a contributor to many of their reports, including one that just came out last month dealing with this subject, that is underfunded state pension systems. It's the $1 trillion gap. That's what they call it. Came out in February. If you want to read it, you can go to their website. Here in the studio with me is Fred Gertz. He is a professor of economics here at the University of Illinois. He's also a member of the Board of Trustees of the State University's retirement system. And also Jeff Brown is here. He's professor of finance, director of the Center for Business and Public Policy. And this particular issue, that is employee benefits and retirement issues, something that he's done a lot of writing and research on, both when it comes to public sector employees, private sector employees. That's something we've talked about here before on the program as well. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. We have several callers here. Let's get right to them. And again, callers will help us by being as brief as they can. That way we can get in as many as we can. We'll start out with the Peoria and Line 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. The predicament is that the average Joe is getting hammered with taxes every time there's a problem. And who creates the problems? The government does. And people are starting to realize that. They're actually getting smart. The problem you have is that you, when they, everybody wants everything. I mean, there isn't a group out there that you want something. You want something, your neighbor wants something, your neighbor's neighbors want something. It's always different. And they're trying to accommodate everybody, and they can't. You know, fiscally, you can't do it. There's no way that any state or any company can help everyone, you know, with their special interest. And that's the problem. And when you get started down that road, when the economy is great, that's fine. But then when we have a downturn like we do now, then the money's not coming in. People are losing jobs because the companies hired way too many people in the beginning. They were doing double, triplicate the same job and so forth. There are ways, having worked for the government myself, there are ways you can actually save money as a government, whether it be a company or a government-run issue. You can leave it to private contractors. You can, like mowing the state highways, or the pickup of the trash on the state highways can be done by contractors. Two things. You're not paying for the benefits of the people that go out and mow. You're not paying. The other thing is you're not paying for the equipment. Also, that's a big, massive upkeep of, you know, lawnmowers, trucks to pull them, trailers and whatnot. Having done that, you know, having said what I'm saying here, nobody's willing to go the extra mile because it'd be considered committing political suicide.
I think we're just drifting just off the topic a tiny bit. I don't know if you want to respond directly to what the
There is one thing the caller said that I think is worth highlighting, and Fred alluded to this earlier, which is, and it does tie back in some part to this impairment clause issue, which is we do have a situation, which is a bad situation, which is when we are in economic good times and the pension looks like funding levels are starting to creep up, then we have a history in this state and in other states of the politicians then saying, wow, we've got a little extra money there. We can extend benefits to other workers. We can change the treatment of overtime. We can increase the generosity of the pension system and so forth. But then the problem is during bad times, they're not able to undo those things because now we've locked in these higher level of benefits due to the non-impairment clause. And it does create an asymmetry in our funding obligations, which just has a tendency over time to just ratchet it up. Mm. And it is a serious problem.
Well, it seems that though that in a sense, maybe we have two kind of issues here. One is that even if starting today, the University of Illinois didn't hire anybody new, nobody new came into the system, we still have an issue of how are we going to pay promised benefits to people who are now retired and drawing benefits and who will retire. So there's still this huge problem we have to do something
Absolutely.
About that. And then it seems to me also, and maybe Catherine Barrett, you can talk about this, that what a lot of states are doing is they're saying, okay, starting tomorrow, with people we hire starting tomorrow or in the near future here who are coming into the system, it's not going to be like it was for current retirees.
There are a lot of states that are doing that. It's much easier to change the benefits for new employees than it is for current employees. And while it will take a little while before you start to see savings, the savings do materialize. One really good example is Minnesota, which changed its retirement age by just 1 year in 1989, did it only for new employees. By now, 70% of the employees are covered under that new retirement age. And that saved the state $650 million.
Fred, is this kind of thing, like, for example, here in Illinois, is it likely we're going to see something like we're going to have to raise the age at which people are going to be eligible for benefits, other kinds of changes like that?
Yeah, all those things are on the table and they'll likely be considered. The problem is that, again, they're for new employees, and that takes years to materialize, and we have a huge debt now. So reducing promised benefits for people in 30 or 40 years is maybe a step in the right direction, but doesn't solve our problem today. It will come as no surprise that Illinois politicians are ingenious about doing things like this. So what we would do typically would be to say we're going to change the pension rules and we're going to reduce benefits for people 30 or 40 years from now, and that allows us then to reduce our pension contributions today on the unfunded liability. So we typically bring back these future benefits to the present time, and that gives us an excuse for even less effort in terms of pension funding.
Yeah. Only other point I'd make on this, I agree with everything that Catherine and Fred have said, is that one also needs to recognize that when, say, we're trying to recruit a new faculty member, for example, we're in competition in a labor market where we're competing against other public institutions, other private institutions, and so forth. And so if you cut back on benefits in a competitive labor market, you're going to need to compensate them in some other way, perhaps through additional salary or change teaching loads or any number of other things. And so I suspect that whatever savings comes from those types of things will actually really be less than those numbers suggest, because other costs are going to be creeping up somewhere else in the system.
All right. We have some other callers to get to here locally. We'll start with line one in Urbana. Hello.
Yeah. Hi, good morning.
Yes.
Sort of an interesting situation, and to hear that this is a problem, you know, all over the states. I wonder if any of you have a perspective, an international perspective from countries that may have sort of a, well, we talked, you know, debate about single-payer health care, the single-payer benefits for retirees, and if those countries are doing a lot better having a single system, if those exist, I imagine they do, compared to our just extremely fragmented system here in the U.S.
It may be more a matter of demographics that even though the United States population is not growing rapidly, we're growing rapidly compared to a lot of other developed areas. So if you talk about Spain or Italy or Japan or places like that, they have a huge Social Security problem because of the fact that they have a very large retiree group and relatively small number of workers. So I'm not sure there's any solutions in other areas.
No, I think that's right. In fact, as bad as the financial situation is for the U.S. Social Security system and in most of the European countries, it's even worse for the reasons Fred has stated. So, you know, unfortunately, even regardless of whether you have one system or many, if you've got politicians who are unwilling to fund it and therefore you're subject to demographic pressures, the picture's not very pretty.
Right. Well,
so you're saying that we could be a lot worse off if we didn't have an increasing population. So things must really be bad.
There's actually a bright side to immigration. That immigration has a dynamic force for our economy in a lot of different ways, including the funding of social programs.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Let's go to another caller. This is line two. This is also Urbana. Hello.
Hi. I'm hoping you can quash a rumor and make me feel a little more comfortable. What I've heard is that, okay, the state constitution guarantees pension benefits, that they must be paid, but it doesn't say when they must be paid. And I'm wondering whether we may end up with all getting IOUs from the state.
I don't think so. Your pension includes an amount to be paid. It also includes a date certain that would be paid. So I would assume that if it's not paid on time, it's a violation of the non-impairment clause. Now, we don't have a non-impairment police in Illinois. Someone would have to take it to court or take it to a claims arrangement, something of that sort, but the access is there.
Thank you.
All right. And let's see. Let's take another call. This is line three, and this is Champaign. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I'm really enjoying your program, by the way. But I would like to let the listeners know that as a state employee, at least a University of Illinois employee, we have no Social Security taken out of our checks. And so because of the offset of Social Security, even if you qualified for some benefit, you can't get your full Social Security payment because you're in a defined pension program. And also, if you were employed, I think it was before 1985, no Medicare has been withheld from checks, and that is why having our health insurance benefit when we retire is so important. There's many elderly out there right now that have never paid into Medicare, and if their health insurance is stripped, they won't get Medicare either. So I would like to, well, for one thing, just put it out there and let people know that, you know, the pension payers in this state are actually kind of victims of the whole system, rather than, you know, getting these lavish benefits that some newspapers now like to say that we're getting.
Well, it's true that teachers and at least the university employees are not subject to Social Security, and I actually view that as a considerable benefit and good thing. But there are the downside, obviously, and it's even more problematic in the future if we cut back on new employees, then they would not have the fallback of Social Security in that case. But you're right that Social Security doesn't apply to most of us.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that was implicit in the caller's remark, which I think is important, is that we shouldn't blame the participants. I mean, they, for the most part, most people covered by these systems have come into these systems evaluating, do I want to take a job, say, at University of Illinois versus somewhere else? And they take this benefit package into account when they do that. The fact that our politicians have not seen fit to properly set aside the money to fund those benefits is certainly not the fault of the participants. We'd all like them to be funding it.
Yeah, I have a preliminary study here based on the State University Retirement System, and sort of a what-if study. What if the state had appropriately funded the pension system on a year-by-year basis? Any time the state funded less than the actuarial required amount, which is approximately 10%, we said what would happen had we put in that money. Anytime the state on occasion funded more lavishly, we took that away. And despite the traumatic downturn last year, the State University Retirement System be funded about 106% now had we put in the appropriate contribution on a year-to-year basis. And these are not heroic contributions. They're basically 10% of people's salaries.
All right. Well, again, I want to thank the caller. And just, again, sort of another point for as far as the Illinois situation is concerned, for people who might want to fix blame here on a particular administration, particular governor, or particular legislature, this problem of not paying into the system. This has been going on now at least since the 80s?
Since forever. But it became more severe. We actually blinked, though. In 1995, this problem was recognized, at least to a certain extent, and we set ourselves on a path to try to get back to better funding. And it was we didn't hasten to do that. We had a 10-year ramp where we didn't really fully fund things for about 10 years, but we had this program in place from 1995 on up to 2030 or 2040 that would have brought us back to full funding. But when we got to 2003 and 4 and 5 and Governor Blagojevich and the money started to actually amount to large amounts of the state budget, they blinked and took us off that path. So there'd been not everyone's equally to blame, but I think everyone is to blame.
We have
there are a lot of lessons to be learned from the past, I think that the real issue will be when the economy recovers a bit, and then what you want to see is the money going into the pension system then.
I want to here again ask Catherine Barrett. She's the last person you heard speaking here to talk. Maybe you can talk a bit more about how in various states they're dealing with this issue. As we have said, there are sort of two problems, and they may indeed, there are a lot of places where they're perhaps looking at making changes for future retirees, but that still doesn't help you with whatever your current problem is. How are states trying to deal with this?
Well, there are a number of states that are raising the contribution rate for employees, and not all states can do that, but some can, and so that's one way. There are states that are raising their retirement ages. Rhode Island did that recently and did that for some current employees as well as new employees. And there are some states that are changing the nature of the systems, if subtly. For example, Oregon went to a kind of a hybrid system. Nebraska has what's called a cash balance plan, which is kind of half defined benefit and half defined contribution.
We're a little bit past our midpoint here, more than a little. We're into our last about 15 minutes, and I'd like to introduce all of the guests For people who have just tuned in, Catherine Barrett is with us by telephone. She's a senior advisor to the Pew Center on the States and has been a lead contributor to a number of their reports, including one that just came out last month that deals with this subject. So if you're interested, you can go to their website and look at the report, The Trillion Dollar Gap. Here in the studio, Fred Gertz, he's professor of economics here at the U of I. He's also a member of the Board of Trustees of the State University's Retirement System. And Jeff Brown, he's professor of finance and also director of the Center for Business and Public Policy. And both you guys are affiliated with IGPA, right? Institute.
I am. I'm not sure.
Public Yeah, both. Both of them are. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let me maybe get in a couple of email questions here. We have someone writing in says, can't the state just go through a structured bankruptcy like the automakers and lower the, in the words of this writer, lavish pensions it awarded?
Yeah, there's no such thing as state bankruptcy. The local governments can go bankrupt, but under the states are, have a kind of sovereign position in the U.S. system of government, and there's no states could become insolvent, but they can't become bankrupt. So it's sort of uncharted water there. I'm not sure. Jeff has any.
No, that's correct. And the constitutional provision would trump anything along those lines anyway. Yeah. So there's no solution there.
Maybe and here's another question, and I don't know if this is something Catherine Baird can talk about or one of the guys here in the studio. And it has to do with tax rates and how our tax rates compare with those in other states. And the caller was wondering, well, if you look at those states where they are actually properly funding their obligations, what do their state tax rates look like? Catherine, is that something you can talk about?
That's not really something that I can talk about, but my reaction is that you won't see particularly higher tax rates in those states that are fully funded. Mm-hmm. You'll just see a different kind of behavior over time.
One of the, and I don't know if this is something that you guys would know about, one, in fact, according to this report, one of the states that in 2008, in the period that we're talking about here, that actually was fully funded was Wisconsin. So their neighboring, what's their tax
system? It's a little bit higher, but not greatly higher, more progressive. Wisconsin has a history of progressive politics and so on, so they have a income tax is not a flat rate, but it's not greatly different. The kind of bizarre thing is that if you had to name the two most dysfunctional states in the country, I think Illinois and New York would be right up there neck and neck. But Illinois is terribly funded and New York is well-funded. And I think maybe the reason New York is well-funded is that the workers don't trust the state and wanted to have the money in the bank, and they actually negotiated for pension contributions, while in Illinois, because of the non-impairment clause, we didn't really ever do that.
Okay. Let's go back to the phones here. Champagne, line one. Hello.
I've got two questions. The first question is, what would it be like if the state shifted so that those who aren't on Social Security are part of paying in Social Security as well as a separate pension fund, which would, of course, be lower, because then the state would have to make the Social Security payments. It couldn't put it off. It couldn't do anything else, just like any other employer. I know my own experience. For a while, I worked for various governmental agencies in California, and even though there was a governmental pension program, but there was also Social Security being paid in. So that's the first set of questions, and there's lots of ramifications on that, and you can talk about that. The other questions are about double dipping and triple dipping, which seems to occur with a lot of the governmental pension programs in the state of Illinois, especially with legislative and executive functions and the various administrative functions, and whether there's anything the people of the state can do about that to forbid it. You know, one pension is what you get, not three, four. I mean, the case of ex-Governor George Ryan is particularly egregious example of it. Unfortunately, the courts have stopped him.
Yeah.
So,
well,
thank you.
All right. Yeah, thank you.
You want to do the first one?
Well, sure. You know, there are often calls at the national level to incorporate the remaining states and local governments into the Social Security system. I should note that the primary reason for this is to get more revenue into the Social Security system, which suggests accurately that this is not necessarily a good deal for the workers that would be brought in. It would have one effect, but there's another important effect it would not have. The one effect it would have is the caller is correct that states would not be able to get around their obligation for making their payments on Social Security. So it would impose funding discipline, and that could be a good thing. On the other hand, given that we already have this large pre-existing funding hole or funding gap, that's not going to magically disappear overnight because, you know, you would have to transition into a new system. And the tens of billions of dollars that are currently owed to those that have accrued benefits under the existing system, those are going to be there. Those are going to be there whether we shut the system down tomorrow, keep it open, shift to Social Security, what have you. And so it doesn't eliminate that problem that we would have.
Yeah, the double-dipping problem is different in different situations. There's no limitation if someone has a local pension to have a state pension. There are limitations. For example, if someone retires from SERS, they can go back and work, but they can't earn more than the combination of their pension benefits plus and their old salary. So if someone's making 75% of their salary, they could go back and work and earn 25% of their salary. And that's not, from my standpoint, that's not necessarily a bad thing to do, to have experienced people work on a part-time basis. The egregious kind of situations are ones where people were retiring from one state job and then moving to a city job or vice versa, things of that sort, where they were truly double-dipping.
Okay. It's probably worth it to look at where the pension system might be leaking money through abuses. It's hard to say how much could actually be saved by cleaning those up. One thing that has come up in some states is the issue of spiking pension benefits through overtime. I think that there was some reform in Illinois about that, but it may still be a problem in the law enforcement area.
Yeah, we have a rule that any increase more than 20% any one year doesn't count towards pension benefits. And then during the final several years of someone's employment, any increase in salary over 6%, the cost of that has to be borne by the granting institution, not by the pension system. So that's an attempt to deal with the spiking issue. The spiking issue has not been as a serious problem at the university system, somewhat more a problem at the community college systems, and it's been really a problem in the school districts around the state. But there's been attempts to address that. I don't think it's been fully dealt with yet.
We're coming to the point where we're getting into our last maybe 6-7 minutes, and I will try to get some other callers here, but I've had an off-air question here, and I think it's a good question, and I want to make sure that I allow some time here to do this, and particularly for Jeff Brown and Fred Gertz, but you know, maybe Catherine Barrett, you'd like to weigh in this too. People would like you to talk about what you think we should do, and particularly here in the state of Illinois. Okay. What do you think we should do?
Okay. Well, I go back to my original statement that pensions are only a part of the whole problem. I have a quote from Homer Simpson. It says, "To alcohol, the cause of and solution to all of life's problems." Well, Illinois now, we seem to think that pensions are the cause of all of our problems and the solution to all our problems. In fact, pensions are part of the big picture. Pensions did not cause our current situation. We use pensions as a way of spending more than we had available to spend, and that's now coming home to roost. So we have to address the pension issues clearly. There are a lot of things we need to do there, but we need more importantly to address the overall state finance situation, which is in a terrible position right now. So we don't want to try to solve all of the state's problems just with the pension system. Pensions are part of the problem, part of the equation, but only a modest part of that.
I agree with that, and I think I would add that while it's probably not realistic to think we could ever get it here, I think I would probably be in favor of requiring our legislators to make their pension contributions every year. If nothing else, it would enforce some fiscal discipline on them to actually not be able to use the pension system as a piggy bank from which to borrow to fund the other things that they want to be able to do. But aside from that, we are constrained as to what we can do because, once again, of this non-impairment clause, we can't really do much to reduce the pension obligation. So that just means that someday, some way, we're going to have to come up with the revenue to pay for that, whether it's cutting spending elsewhere in the state or whether it's raising taxes. And, of course, no one's really in the mood to do either of those things.
Yeah. I would just add that it's just really, really important to make those annual contributions each year, and particularly when the economy starts doing well again. Not to slide back into bad habits, and not to think if the funding level increases that then you can just increase benefits as well, or if the economy does well, take that money and do something else with it because it just needs to be funded.
Yeah, so the good news in Illinois is that we actually several years in the past, we have funded our pensions appropriately. The bad news is we've done it by borrowing. So last year we borrowed money to make the pension contributions. The governor's budget this year envisions also borrowing money. So we're transferring the problem back to the state in terms of a bonded debt that they have to pay off. And again, that's not solving the problem. It's just moving it down the road.
Yeah. I was just going to add one other thing that Catherine's comment reminded me of, is that I think we ought to basically have some sort of a rule or prohibition in place against any increases in benefits unless there's a very explicit and commitment of how we're going to pay for those increases.
I'm going to ask Catherine Barrett, in those places where the states are fully funding their systems, is that because the legislators have sort of stood up and said to one another, you know, this is really important, we should do this, or is it more that they faced pressure from state workers, from taxpayers, from citizens who have come to them and said, look, this is really important. We really need to do this.
Well, as I said before, in some cases there are laws that require them to fund the system. In other cases, it just appears to be part of the culture of the government that you take care of your long-term responsibilities.
Here in the state of Illinois, if we were going to have such a requirement, would that require a constitutional amendment?
It would, to make it effective. We thought we had the system in place in 1995. We had something called a continuing appropriation. Every year, the General Assembly automatically appropriated the amount of money specified in this plan, and we thought that was great. And it turned out that all you need to end a continuing appropriation is a approval of the General Assembly. So in 2003, that was gone. So I think it has to be at the constitutional level.
Yeah, no, there's another thing that some states have done. In North Carolina, Georgia, Tennessee, all have requirements that there be a very careful analysis of what any kind of benefit will cost long term.
Huh. Here in Illinois, last year, the General Assembly created something called the Illinois Pension Modernization Task Force, and they actually issued a report last fall. Was there anything of any significance to come out of that?
Well, again, I think that sometimes they, if you were doing this de novo, starting a new system, there's some things you could do. Maybe a defined contribution plan has some advantages, things of that sort, but those kind of things don't really save any money for the past underfunding, so they didn't really address very much the past underfunding situation, which is an intractable kind of problem. I mean, you can design a system going forward that may be cheaper and better in some ways, or better or worse, whatever, but different. But it's very difficult to undo what we've done in the past.
All right. Let's take at least to get in one more call. Let's go to Charleston, line number two. Hello.
Hi. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I had a question about our obligation to pay these contracts for the pensions. I'm actually in the CERS system as an employee at a community college, so I feel like it's not that bad for me to talk about this. But there's actually, and I don't know the law that well, but Supreme Court case 1977, United States Trust of New York versus New Jersey, and it seems to give precedent to specifically diminishing or impairing contracts if it is. And this is according to Justice Blackmun, who spoke on behalf of the majority, I believe. If it is reasonable and within the public interest to do so.
Well, I think that's overridden by the constitutional non-impairment clause. There are some states where there's a obligation to pay, but it's not written in the Constitution. But in our case, it's clear there's not any doubt about that. And I don't think there's any legal issue there.
Doesn't
as far as I
know. Doesn't the Supreme Court give, like, in a sense, trump our state law for that says, I mean, especially in this time of need where we're saying, look, everybody has to pull back a little bit. these guarantees that we made, we can't make good on that. So, I mean, don't we have some legal precedent to diminish or at least impair the good of the society?
It's more a question of will compared to capacity. We went into the market last year, I think, ill-advisedly, but we borrowed money, taxable money, at 3.8%. So the credit markets still have a lot of faith in the state of Illinois. So it's not clear to me that we don't have the capacity. The problem is we don't have the will. And the will is going to be difficult to muster, as Jeff has talked about. It's an unpleasant challenge, but we certainly have the ability to do that.
Well, yeah, could I make one other point? Is that with this SIR system that I am part of, we actually, on one of the websites, and I can't remember which site it was, but they listed the top 100 payouts. And the SIR's beneficiaries represented the 94 of the top 100, with the top payout going to a SIR's beneficiary of $370,000.
The reason for that is
what you could do in the student system, or I mean in this university system, to accrue that much pension.
Well, the reason we have that is we have high paid employees. So if you want to get rid of those benefits, you get rid of the medical school in Chicago. We have doctors who are paid substantial amounts of money. There may be a few isolated coaches here and administrators who make this kind of dollars, but the majority of it has to do with the medical school.
I thought that I read, and maybe I misread this, Fred, but you ought to know that the average SIRS annuitant really only received about $30,000.
I think so.
Something in that neighborhood. So it's not like people are not getting these six figure.
Right, but again, this is. It's never intended to be charity, and the fact is that people work. We contribute 8% of our salary. The university is obligated, or the state is obligated, to contribute their share, and that's the benefit. So it's not surprising that people are paid $500,000 to get high pensions. That's going to be true every place. So the question is funding them. And again, if we don't have high-paid people, we can discontinue the athletic program and get rid of the medical school. But the way the world works, those things are here.
Yeah. I'm sorry to say we're going to have to stop at this point. I'm sure it's an issue we can try to get back to. But for the moment, we're going to have to stop and thank our guest, Catherine Barrett. She's a senior advisor to the Pew Center on the States. She's been one of the lead contributors to many Pew reports, including the $1 trillion gap was just issued in February. It's about this issue, and you can read it on the website of the Pew Center for the States. Catherine Barrett, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And here in the studio with me, Fred Gertz, he's professor of economics, and Jeff Brown, he's professor of finance. We appreciate you both being with us. And I guess I also want to mention, if you'd like to read more on the subject, there was a really fine article, I think, in the February issue of the Illinois Issues magazine, which is a magazine comes out of the U of I Springfield about state government. Charlie Wheeler wrote the piece, and I think it's good. So people, you can read it on the website if you want to look at it.
If I can also make a plug, we have a blog for the Center for Business and Public Policy, and it's just called businesspublicpolicy.com, and we actually write about Illinois pension issues occasionally on there.
All right. That's Jeff Brown. Hey, thank you very much for being here. We appreciate it.